Bexar County officials, among others, asking the governor for authority to require face masks as the number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The impact in Texas from yesterday's landmark decision protecting the rights of gay and transgender workers. We'll hear from the head of the State House LGBTQ caucus. Also, almost 3 years after Harvey, the Houstonians caught in the middle of a fight over relief funds and the push to rename Fort Hood for a Texas veteran and Medal of Honor recipient who fought with the United States, not against it. Those stories and a whole lot more coming up when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 16th day of June 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday as we hear reports of the numbers of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations spiking across the Lone Star State. We were also hearing from a growing number of local officials who say they need to do more to deal with another kind of spread. That is the relaxation of attitudes about face masks and social distancing. But officials say their hands are tied as the governor remains committed to reopening Texas. Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf reached out to the governor with a specific request after noting an alarming spike in COVID-19 cases there. Judge Wolf, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Let's start with the latest COVID cases in Bexar County. What are you hearing about hospitalization rates?
Well, what's happened to us, if you go back to June the 1st, we had 93 people in the hospital. Today, we have 187, more than doubled. We had 39 in ICU on June the 1st. We now have 72. Ventilators went from 20 to 33. So we're seeing a huge spike. That's a doubling within 2 weeks. And if that keeps up, you know, we're all going to be in serious trouble.
Last week, Judge, you sent a letter to Governor Greg Abbott saying you were hearing from local health officials concerned about the increase in COVID cases, of course, and you asked that Governor Abbott issue an executive order allowing local jurisdictions to make their own determinations about requiring face masks. Why was that significant?
Well, what happened when he started opening up Texas, I had no objection to that. We all got to work. We can only consume what we collectively produce unless we go into huge debt. We're way beyond the debt capacities. So I supported that, but I thought he made a fatal mistake. And I said so at the time when he took away our authority to make face masks mandatory. We had a $1,000 fine if someone did not wear one that was stripped away. What we've seen where we were having face masks, everybody was wearing them practically. Now, different places, the mall, et cetera, maybe 50, 60% are wearing them. So we've let down our guard. That's why we're having this tremendous upsurge in the number of cases as well as in the number of people that are in the hospital.
Well, now I want to ask what the governor's response was to your letter.
Well, the governor agreed that we should wear face masks, and he's recommended that. But he didn't want to cross the line to make it mandatory. I think that's still a huge mistake, and we're seeing it play out every day. There are people that assert their constitutional right. Well, let me tell you, during an emergency, you do not have a constitutional right to pass on this COVID to someone else that may end up dying because they have a health issue. We don't know from day to day whether we have it or not. We can be asymptomatic, and we can still have it, and we can still pass it. So we have every right during an emergency to require that.
So when you say mandatory, you mean enforceable with some kind of penalty or some kind of criminal sanction?
Well, a penalty would be fine. $1,000 fine is what we had. Jail term, that's off. We would never arrest anybody for any violation. But a penalty, yes, that could work.
During a TV interview yesterday, Governor Abbott said younger Texans, those in their 20s, were part of the reason for this uptick in cases. And I want to quote from the governor here. They're not wearing face masks. They're not sanitizing their hands. They're not maintaining the safe distancing practices. And as a result, they're contracting COVID-19 at a record pace in the state of Texas. Do you disagree?
I think he's exactly right. It is beyond that, because what happens, they passed it to each other, and so they can turn it right around and infect somebody that has a serious health issue, ends up in the hospital, or ends up dying. So he's correct about that. But until we get a mandatory face mask covering, or whatever covering you want to use, people are going to continue to ignore it. Now, let me tell you this. This is positive. A lot of different businesses, and many of them are requiring the face mask before you can come in. That is very, very good. But there are many, many others that are not requiring that. So people are trying to be responsible, but there's a pretty good element that have just let the guard down or really just don't care.
What's next for Bexar County, Judge?
Well, I'm looking at every possible avenue of what we might could do to get the face coverings more on a mandatory measure and still stay in with the confines of the governor's emergency order. He does have the final say. But we're looking at some different issues that might be able to play out and help on this.
Such as?
Well, I'll be getting an opinion from our attorney. There might could be an incentive package used to employers to require the face mask and provide it for them. But we're just looking at some issues like that that might, could do more than just encourage, because the employers really have the enforcement power to do that. And there are some that do it and some that don't.
That's Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf. Judge Wolf, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
We should mention that we've reached out to the governor's office to request his comment, but we have not yet been able to schedule a conversation as of airtime. In a state like Texas, where statewide workplace protections for its LGBTQ community have long been denied, Monday's landmark Supreme Court decision federally protecting LGBTQ workers from being fired from their jobs because of their sexual orientation carries a lot of weight. The decision could especially embolden one group of Texas lawmakers who's been pushing for LGBTQ protections in Texas since this past legislative session. Jessica Gonzalez is a Texas Democratic State House representative. Her district includes parts of Grand Prairie and Cockrell Hill outside of Dallas. Representative Gonzalez, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I know you're also vice chair of the Texas House LGBTQ Caucus, which was created during the 2019 session. First, your reaction to yesterday's Supreme Court decision?
I mean, I was thrilled. It's a historic decision. The United States Supreme Court affirmed that companies can't unfairly fire or discriminate against LGBTQ people in the workplace. It's a landmark ruling and a series of landmark rulings that have come down over the last several years, with Windsor, marriage equality, and now workplace discrimination. The ruling set court precedent that the term sex under the 1964 Civil Rights Act includes sexual orientation and gender identity. While the court's ruling yesterday is progress and a step in the right direction, we still have a lot of work to do to protect all Texans.
Well, then let's talk about that work ahead. I know that some of these protections, as I understand it, something your group was going to continue to push for in the 2021 session. What's been the pushback so far, and where do you go with this decision?
There hasn't been pushback. I mean, it's still going to be a top priority, at least for me and the caucus, to pass a bipartisan comprehensive non-discrimination bill through the Texas House for the first time in history. And this bill would extend non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ folks in employment, housing, and public accommodations in state law. Texas is one of 27 states where we have no protections from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Although the court, had its ruling yesterday, we still need to have it enumerated into law. And so it's going to continue being a top priority for us to pass that.
Well, for those who may not understand, what exactly does it mean if Texas doesn't have those protections, but the federal government does? Doesn't federal law trump state law?
It does, but we still need to have it enumerated into law to ensure that people don't continue to be discriminated against. It needs to be consistent because people will continue to get discriminated. I mean, there's the court, the Supreme Court has made other rulings, and we still have state law that isn't consistent with it. And, you know, people will use old law or antiquated law to continue to discriminate against LGBTQ people.
Are there other protections your group will be seeking in the 2021 session, or are you going to go back to the last session and look to try to advance those initiatives?
Well, you know, I mentioned that, you know, my priority is going to be passing this comprehensive non-discrimination law. You know, Representative Celia Israel, each session has filed her bill relating to banning conversion therapy. Representative Mary Gonzalez is going to refile her what she calls Romeo and Juliet law. Representative Zwiener is going to work on trying to reverse the law in Texas on foster care as it relates to LGBTQ people. And Representative Johnson is going to focus on healthcare issues that affect the LGBTQ community.
Why did you and several other lawmakers feel it was important to create the LGBTQ caucus, Representative Gonzalez? Why last session?
Well, this was the first time in history that we had five open members or folks that were LGBTQ in the Texas House. Before, there's always only ever been two. And, you know, our community needed something. I think it was they needed to feel positive about something. And knowing that we have these five women in the Texas House that is going to not only advocate for issues that are important to our community, but then also, you know, when we have to play defense on laws that would come through that would discriminate against LGBTQ folks.
Representative Jessica Gonzalez is a Texas Democratic State House representative and vice chair of the Texas House LGBTQ Caucus. Representative Gonzalez, thanks again.
Thank you.
Let's check in with our social mediator, find out what Texans are talking about. Wells Dunbar, how you doing?
Hey, David, doing okay. You know, we're hearing about the apparent drop-off in the number of people wearing face masks in public. As the judge from Bexar County described earlier, with state laws superseding local rules, cities and counties can't make masks mandatory. Via Twitter, Prova Texan says, I'm in Houston, and it seems every time I go out, fewer and fewer people are wearing masks. And on Facebook, Kate Taylor Hearn says, children will have been out of school for 5 months by mid-August. Please, for their sake, wear a mask, social distance. Maybe if we all think about the kids and how we can support their futures, we could all do the right thing. She adds, it would be wonderful if we had a governor who would mandate these safety precautions, but we just don't. And speaking of the governor, we're also receiving a lot of reactions about the governor's words blaming young Texans for that spike in COVID cases that you referred to earlier, David. I'll be back with some of those reactions and more.
Of course, Wells Dunbar needs to hear from you, and he would love to. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, with more of the talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At-home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The toll from Hurricane Harvey has been put in the billions of dollars, but nearly 3 years later, the city of Houston and the state of Texas are blaming each other for the interminable delays in getting federal relief to homeowners. As the two sides point fingers at one another, caught in the middle are thousands of Houstonians still waiting for relief. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has more.
During Harvey's record rains, when the Army Corps of Engineers released water from attics and Barker reservoirs, it flooded Leslie Friedrich's development. She lives in a townhome in Houston's West Memorial neighborhood.
We had about 4 feet of water here, so we all had to be evacuated by boat, all 194 townhomes.
She stayed with friends and relatives for 6 months while her home was rebuilt, but her insurance didn't pay for all her repairs. She maxed out her credit cards and borrowed against her 401k to pay for the rest.
I had about $35,000 worth of repairs that my insurance did not pay for.
So when the city of Houston announced the Harvey Homeowners Assistance Program, Friedrich applied. What followed was 2 years of paperwork, inspections, and delay after delay. And the interest on her debt continued to hammer her. Finally, this April, Friedrich got an answer from the city.
They spent, you know, $6.90 to send me a certified letter saying that while I was eligible for the Harvey Homeowners Assistance Program, I had no unmet needs. Now, how vague is that?
Bottom line, she doesn't qualify. According to the City of Houston's records, over 9,000 homeowners have been invited to apply for assistance. But as of April, less than 1%, only 50 people, had received a reimbursement check. Another 70 people have gotten the green light from the city to rebuild. Brittany Eck is with the Texas General Land Office's disaster recovery effort.
This is lagging far behind projections of where they need to be in order to spend this money within the required 6 years that HUD has allowed.
In April, the Land Office notified Houston it intended to take over the billion-dollar recovery effort to rebuild homes.
These numbers are insufficient in the home repair program.
But whose fault is that, asks Tom McCasland, who runs Houston's Housing and Community Development Department.
And we are ready to work with them to make the changes necessary to make sure people get served.
McCasland says it's the state's land office that's to blame for why the recovery is moving so slowly, because, he says, state officials require so much paperwork before repairs can proceed. He says Texas has more red tape than Louisiana after Katrina or New York after Sandy.
To come in and suggest that as a result of a program that they control the approval on, they're going to take over the entire program, is a slap in the face to every municipality in the state.
That may be, but a state takeover would make some Houston homeowners happy. Take Lloyd Nelms. Nelms was flooded out of his home in northeast Houston on the fourth day of Harvey. He spent over 2 years waiting for the city to help before the state offered to build him a new house in March.
I think the Texas General Land Office are doing an awesome job. They were transparent from beginning to end. What the city of Houston told me they was doing with the last 2.5 to 3 years, they have done in less than 45 days.
Nelms moved into his new house ahead of schedule this May. As for Leslie Friedrich, flooded by the reservoir's release, she's appealing the city's ruling and still trying to get reimbursed. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. A lot of people are opening up their wallets these days and thinking twice before making that next purchase. So, when it comes to that staple of the Texas diet, barbecue, what do? Do you give it up altogether? Daniel Vaughn's not about to. He is the barbecue editor for Texas Monthly, and he's been offering some advice on how to stretch that barbecue, which, Daniel, I understand is something of an issue among major barbecuers these days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, with brisket being the, you know, sort of foundation of Texas barbecue and what most customers expect when they go into a barbecue joint, it's kind of tough these days because that brisket is more expensive than ever. So, if barbecue joints are going to be able to make any money, their prices are going to have to start reflecting the prices that they get charged for it.
You've been speaking with one of Texas's most preeminent pitmasters, one Aaron Franklin of Franklin Barbecue, right?
Yeah, that's right. I gave Aaron Franklin a call because he just made it into the Barbecue Hall of Fame this year. Part of our conversation, really most of our conversation, wasn't really about the Hall of Fame. It was about, you know, he is also seeing unprecedented prices from for the beef that he's purchasing. He had told me the most he had ever spent before was $5.98 a pound for brisket. He orders from Creekstone. And last week, that number was $7.76 a pound.
Wow.
So he's paying $7.76 a pound. After he trims it up and smokes it, 15-pound brisket, he's got about 5 pounds of barbecue that he can sell in the end. And so when that's $7.76 a pound coming in, like, he's now charging $35 a pound for brisket, which is, you know, by far the highest price I've ever seen in Texas. And it's really just because, you know, these pitmasters, these restaurant owners, they've got to reflect the price that they're paying. I mean, I'm sure we're all seeing it. You go to the grocery store and you see those price increases. Well, they're certainly not getting any better deals from their meat suppliers.
Well, given those prices, what's a Texan to do, especially one that's watching their budgets? I mean, you talk about ways to stretch your barbecue. How would you do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, number one, just put it on a potato. You know, that big old bubba tater, the big stuffed baked potato. Or fry up some tater tots and do some barbecue top tots or some fries, like those swamp fries they do out at Riverport Barbecue in Jefferson. You know, it's just one of those ways that you can take a cheaper ingredient, pair it up with your barbecue, and come up with something that's still really filling, still gives you that sort of comfort of barbecue, but, you know, doesn't use just meat in the dish.
Here's another terrific suggestion that's 100% Texan, it seems to me. Break out those tortillas.
Yeah, that's right. You know, before all this pandemic went down, I took a road trip to four or five different cities to check out all these different breakfast options that barbecue joints are putting out. And, you know, a lot of the breakfast options were, you know, breakfast tacos. Those barbecue breakfast tacos, mix up some brisket or some sausage with eggs, put it on a tortilla. Or heck, just, you know, take the barbecue itself and make a lunch taco out of it as well. So, yeah, the taco is just as versatile as the bun, that's for sure.
And for those who are so inclined, you don't have to get rid of all those trimmings either. You could probably put those to some good use.
Yeah, you know, if you look back at the history of Texas barbecue, so often the meat markets themselves were using those leftovers for barbecue and using the trimmings to make smoked sausage. And sausage itself is certainly the best way, I think, to use those trimmings. But not everybody has the time, inclination, or maybe even the skill to or equipment required to make a great sausage. But you can still grind up those brisket trimmings and make some incredible burgers or make some smoked meatloaf. So there's plenty of ways to use those trimmings other than just making sausage.
And there are plenty more ways that Daniel Vaughn details for Texas Monthly in his piece, How to Stretch Your Barbecue. We'll link to it over at texasstandard.org. Daniel Vaughn is the barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. Daniel, good to talk with you again. Stay safe and happy.
Thanks, you too.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The state of Texas is set today to execute its first inmate since the pandemic began. Attorneys for Ruben Gutierrez have asked the U.S. Supreme Court and Governor Greg Abbott to intervene. One reason they're requesting a stay is that the Texas Department of Criminal Justice in 2019 stopped allowing chaplains to enter the death chamber. The agency rolled out the policy after the Supreme Court halted the execution of a different death row inmate, ruling he faced discrimination because his Buddhist spiritual advisor was not permitted in the chamber. Sean Nolan, who represents Gutierrez, says the ban violates his client's rights.
Hundreds of people have been executed in Texas that have been allowed to have their spiritual advisors with them in the execution chamber. And so Mr. Gutierrez has that same right.
Gutierrez was sentenced to death for the 1998 killing of Escolastica Harrison in Brownsville. He and his attorneys argued DNA testing would prove his innocence. A senior member of the Texas Senate wants the state legislature to prohibit commercial TV crews from riding along with law enforcement. Houston Democrat John Whitmire is proposing the ban in response to the 2019 death of a 40-year-old black man at the hands of Williamson County Sheriff's deputies. Members of the cable show Live PD filmed the officers as they pursued Javier Ambler in a car chase for 22 minutes for failing to dim his lights to oncoming traffic. The deputies ultimately shocked Ambler with a taser four times as he told them he had a heart condition and could not breathe. Whitmire suggests the deputies were looking for action because of the TV crew.
Quite frankly, I don't think police ought to get after anyone for not dimming their lights. Should they dim lights? Yes, but it's not, in my judgment, the best use of police resources or their contact with the public. And then you've learned that they're actually looking for a TV show. I think I know why they got after him.
State Senator Whitmire is also calling for the Texas Rangers to investigate. And the Texas A&M University System is launching a $100 million scholarship fund to ensure students at all 11 campuses are more reflective of the state's demographics. Elaine Mendoza chairs the Board of Regents, which approved the funding Monday.
The Board of Regents has been steadfastly committed to ensure that all of our schools serve Texans and ultimately look like Texans.
Just over 50% of the Texas population is Black or Hispanic, but Black and Hispanic students only comprise a quarter of enrollment at Texas A&M's flagship campus in College Station. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As coronavirus continues to spread in ICE detention facilities across the country, the calls for large-scale releases of immigrants are growing louder. At the Port Isabel Detention Center in South Texas, detainees are on a hunger strike to protest the conditions they say make outbreaks inevitable. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leanos Jr. reports.
Detainees at the Port Isabel Detention Center have been concerned about a COVID-19 outbreak at the facility for months now. They say some employees at the facility don't wear proper protective equipment when interacting with them, and that it's hard to practice social distancing because they live in close quarters. That's a Cuban detainee at the Port Isabel Detention Center. He and another detainee started a hunger strike at the end of May, but he says they were brought to El Pozo, the hole, which is basically like solitary confinement. He says they were sent there for participating in the hunger strike and to discourage others from joining. Norma Herrera is with the RGV Equal Voice Network. She's been in touch with the hunger strikers and other detainees at the facility.
The latest information we have coming from people detained is that there are 9 dorms under quarantine. They estimate that there's an average of 35 people per dorm. That's approximately 315 people under quarantine right now.
ICE says it fully respects the rights of all people to voice their opinion without interference, and that they do not retaliate against hunger strikers. The agency did not comment on how many dorms are currently under quarantine. Herrera says the detainees have told her the virus is still spreading at the facility because ICE keeps moving people from dorm to dorm.
Even though people are expressing concerns and saying, no, we don't want to move, we don't want to get infected, and then the people that are moved into their dorm end up showing symptoms the very next day.
ICE says it tests detainees showing symptoms and medically isolates those who test positive. It says detainee relocations are necessary for continued safety. The agency is also making use of a practice called cohorting. It involves housing detainees together who are believed to have been exposed to an infected person, but are asymptomatic. ICE says medical isolation is ideal, but some facilities don't have enough individual cells.
You know, we're definitely pushing for folks to be released, but I think when I talk to people, sometimes they'll even say, I would rather just be deported than be left here to die. I don't want to be left here to die. If we're going to die, we should be with our families.
I spoke to a detainee last month around the time when the facility confirmed its first positive coronavirus case. He said he'd been at the facility since February and asked ICE to quickly deport him because he was afraid of contracting the virus at the facility and dying. He didn't want his name used because he feared ICE would retaliate against him for speaking out. He told me he has asthma and has difficulty breathing at night.
When he went into the facility, he had with him his asthma medication and the allergy medication. And plus, he needs that machine so that he can sleep and get the proper oxygenation he needs. But he's been telling me more than a few times that they didn't have the medicine and the machine was not cleaned properly. And they didn't allow me to go and bring him his own machine.
That's his wife. She also didn't want her name used because she feared speaking out will put her husband in danger. Her husband and other detainees say they have had trouble getting information from officials at the facility about what COVID-19 precautions are being taken.
When my husband called me, he also told me, can you please find out more about it? Because the only thing we know is that there's a person that's been already that contracted the virus here at the facility, but no one says anything and nobody talks about it and nobody gives us any information.
She says having her husband in detention has been difficult for their family. He's lived in the U.S. most of his life. She says he ended up at the Port Isabel Detention Center after he was approached by immigration officials at a public place near the border.
He was stopped, he was questioned, and whatever paperwork that he had with him, they didn't believe that was his identity. So they took him in and they discovered, you know, that he had no, he was not an American citizen.
Her husband was deported back to his country of origin a few days ago and is now in quarantine there.
We wish that at least during this time of the virus, we would have been together.
Even though he's no longer at the facility, she worries about the other detainees that remain there. Congressman Filimon Vela of South Texas sent a letter to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security demanding the release of nonviolent detainees for the safety of the detainees, ICE employees, and the general public. There are now 36 cases at the facility at last check, and advocates worry that Port Isabel will follow the trend of other facilities around the country that have become major COVID-19 hotspots. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Los Fresnos.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
I'm Robert Camper, or Bob Camper. Well, I live in Round Rock, Texas. Got interested in the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, and I eventually joined the Williamson County chapter of the Native Plant Society of Texas, and proceeded to turn my rather poor St. Augustine lawn into a native plant scape. There are many that are looked upon as weeds. My favorite is probably the celestial lily that blooms approximately around the beginning of spring. It's a beautiful blue, light blue to dark lavender, and lasts just for a couple of weeks.
The native plants of Texas are the only plants for me. They grow high up in the mountains, cross the plains down to the sea.
So I put the lyrics that I made up to the Yellow Rose of Texas, which I thought was a state song, but it's not.
Blue bonnets on the roadsides, bursting into blooms of blue and bold. Indian blankets, Mexican hats, turn that blue to red and gold.
I would love it if they would name the native plants of Texas to the tune of the Yellow Rose of Texas as the Texas native plant song. We could get a well-known name to do a recording and have that for Texas PSAs and whatnot. That would be a dream fulfilled for me.
The native plants of Texas are the best plants you will know.
This is Bob Camper, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, there's a hotel in Juarez that's filling up with guests. That's because migrant shelters that are trying to control the spread of COVID-19 can't take new people in immediately. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, this establishment, which organizers call a filter hotel, offers a safe space for people to do two-week quarantines before moving on to long-term shelter.
Hotel Flamingo is really more of a motel with lots of open outdoor space. When you arrive, there's a whole disinfection process led by hotel coordinator Rosa Mani Arias. First, you step inside a tray filled with diluted bleach to clean off the soles of your shoes. Then you scrub with soap at a hand washing station, followed up with a big squirt of hand sanitizer. Next, you're given a fresh face mask, and finally, Mani sprays your shoes with an alcohol mixture. Mani is with the World Organization for Peace, one of the many groups behind the Filter Hotel. Once new guests have washed up, they're led to chairs in a well-spaced waiting area, where Mani explains the dynamic here. Every guest goes through a health screening, then is assigned a private room, where they'll quarantine for 14 days. Leticia Chavarria is the hotel's medical coordinator.
We're taking migrants off the street and away from the risk of potential infection.
There is an isolation wing for people with COVID symptoms or who've come into contact with someone who's infected. Protocols are strict. Once a doctor goes up to the isolation area, she can't come down until her shift's over. Anything she needs gets sent up in a bucket on the end of a rope. A makeshift elevator, Chavarria laughs, a solution born out of necessity. There's room for 108 guests here. Right now, it's about 3/4 full. Some of them, because of a Trump administration policy, are forced to wait in Mexico as their asylum cases play out in the U.S. The coronavirus pandemic's made paying rent elsewhere nearly impossible. Others, like this Honduran woman, have been rapidly expelled from the border under a public health directive issued as concern about COVID-19 increased. She asked us not to use her name out of fear for her family's safety. Standing outside her room, she takes in the fresh air while her 4-year-old son plays behind her, stacking blocks into small towers. She says she sold candy in Honduras, earning just enough to get by. Then a local gang tried to extort her. When she couldn't pay,
they told me I had less than 12 hours to leave my country or they would kill me, along with my children.
She fled before the pandemic, but by the time she arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, officials were turning nearly all unauthorized migrants away, including asylum seekers. Authorities now take down basic information in the field, then almost immediately send most people back into Mexico or put them on a flight to their home country. This Honduran mother says she was detained after crossing the border.
They grabbed me worse than you would an animal.
She claims she was left with bruises and ripped clothes. Officials took her photo and fingerprints, she says, then dropped her on an international bridge without explanation.
They didn't tell me anything. They just did that without giving me any reason. It was really ugly.
Mexican officials brought her to the Filter Hotel. She tells me she's grateful to be here, but isn't sure what's next.
I can't go back to my country.
For 2 weeks at least, her family has a safe place to stay. Small touches make the hotel feel more homey, like flower pots on the windowsill. Her kids painted them during an outdoor art class, led from a distance by a volunteer teacher. They all get food and medical care, including twice daily checkups from volunteer doctors. Eunice Gonzalez is one of 6 doctors, all women, who work here. Gonzalez identifies with the guests. She's an asylum seeker. She left Cuba last year and has been living in Juarez waiting for her U.S. court dates.
It had been more than a year since I'd practiced medicine. You miss your profession because medicine is a profession that you study, but also that you feel, and you like helping people.
When she heard the Filter Hotel needed doctors, she was eager to sign up. It may not seem like much, she says, but monitoring people for 14 days means when they go back into the community, they won't be spreading coronavirus.
For me, it's a huge honor to get up every day at 6 in the morning, get ready, come here, and put on my white coat. There's no comparison.
Gonzalez's next hearing is in July, though it's not clear if all immigration courts will reopen by then.
Sometimes you lose hope because it's been very hard, but I haven't considered giving up my case.
And for now, this hotel has given her a sense of purpose and given so many others a place to shelter while they wait. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Around the country, monuments to the Confederacy are falling. Statues and plaques to men who openly rebelled against the Union to maintain slavery are being removed, and many think it shouldn't stop there. Our nation's armed forces often train and live in facilities named for Confederate officers. Texas is no exception. An hour north of Austin, Fort Hood, the most populous military base in the nation, is named for General John Bell Hood, who led the Texas Brigade during the Civil War. If Hood's name were to be removed from the base, there are ideas about what should go there to replace it. One of them was put forward by Jorge Haynes, an Air Force veteran from Laredo who now lives in Lakeway. Mr. Haynes, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
You had the idea to rename Fort Hood for a Texas soldier, a Green Beret, as I understand it, who served in the Korean and Vietnam Wars and was a Medal of Honor recipient named Roy Benavides. Tell us a little bit about his life and his military service.
Sure. Master Sergeant Roy Benavides, besides the Congressional Medal of Honor and a number of other distinguished awards, had 5 Purple Hearts. That means he was injured at 5 different times. He was raised in near El Campo, in a little town near El Campo, Texas. I had the pleasure of getting to know him a couple of times, and he was just a real easygoing, gentle guy. You know, he carried with him the scars of war, because not only did he have the scars, but he also was in a lot of pain oftentimes and had to deal with it through painkillers back in the day. And you know, back in the day, they didn't diagnose PTSD, but I'm sure that he had PTSD also. When people would introduce him, they would introduce him as a hero, and he would always start out by saying, "I'm not a hero, I just did my job."
So the people understand what the sort of thing that he was known for. Do you recall the story from Vietnam where he saved so many people on a helicopter? Do you know that story?
Yes. The helicopter was shut down, and they were getting a lot of enemy fire, and they called in for a medevac. Roy just, in spite of getting injured, just wouldn't give up, protected those soldiers, and got them out of there. I think it was 5 or 7 soldiers that he got out of there.
I understand that he was injured. He jumped out of the helicopter where he was going to be medevaced. He went out, was being shot at, on his way to recover the bodies of his fellow service members, got him back onto the helicopter, and even as he was injured, was able to get away. Is that true?
That's exactly right.
How did this idea to rename Fort Hood after him begin to percolate for you?
So I belong to a LULAC Council 777, which is known as the Veterans Council. Most of the guys in that council met Roy at one time or another, because he came to Laredo on 3 or 4 different occasions. And everybody that came in touch with him, you know, was really impressed by him, by his gentleness and by his humility. And, you know, just in conversation, it wasn't anything deliberate. It's like, hey, this guy should have something named after him. He's got schools and he's got parks named after him. But, you know, they ought to name something bigger after this guy. And Laredo had a guy named, that was a Congressional Medal of Honor winner, that had a camp named after him, Camp Barkley, up in North Texas. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the idea that some of us had, that, you know, maybe we need to look at some of these forts. And we really weren't looking at it in terms of Confederate generals had been named. We were just looking at it in terms of, here's a great guy that deserves a little more recognition than he's mm-hmm. gotten.
So now the idea is getting a lot of support publicly. I've seen stories in the Washington Post and the Dallas Morning News, and there's even support among many in the military, but the president hasn't shown a willingness to rename any of these bases named for Confederate soldiers. Are you optimistic that there might be a change this time, that Fort Hood might become Fort Benavides?
If nothing else, we started a conversation, and when we say Roy Benavides, there's many other heroes that deserve recognition. You know, we think of the Tuskegee Airmen, we think about the 442nd Combat Regiment, which was made up of Japanese whose parents were locked up in concentration camps here in the United States during the war. We think about the Buffalo Soldiers. We think about people like General Richard Cavazos, who's the only Latino ever to ever achieve 4 stars in the military. General Colin Powell certainly is one of those guys that merits that. You know, maybe it's time to update it. Maybe it's time to look at some of these other heroes that are more contemporary that we can relate to and that fought to defend this country.
Jorge Haynes is an Air Force veteran who started a petition to rename Fort Hood after the late Texan Master Sergeant Roy Benavides. Mr. Haynes, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
You're very welcome.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells, I gotta tell you, the more I read mm-hmm. about Master Sergeant Roy Benavides, wow, what an incredible story. The Dallas Morning News did an interesting write-up recently, and I would encourage mm-hmm. everyone to Google it. It's a really powerful story, and what a courageous hero. He really was quite an individual.
Really staggering stuff. Yeah, I was reading a similar write-up in Texas Monthly all about his heroic exploits there. Right. So quite the story there, quite the individual. Well, I'll tell you what, David, boy, are we hearing about those words from the governor blaming young Texans for letting their guard down and leading to the state spike in COVID-19 cases. Mm-hmm. As you noted yesterday, the governor blamed 20-somethings, without citing any real data, we should add, for failing to follow proper social distancing recommendations, and saying, quote, as a result, they are contracting COVID-19 at a record pace in the state of Texas. Speaking of record paces, on our Facebook page, folks are really talking this one over. We're closing in on about 100 comments as of this moment. Wow. One of them, representative of the most sentiment, I would say there, comes from Susan Nahar. She says, I blame Governor Abbott for not following safe guidelines for opening and pushing for everything to reopen too quickly. She says, this is crazy, and now because of his policies, Texas has a huge number of new infections as well as hospitalizations. Seeing a lot of reaction come in via Twitter as well, here's another tweet from Genevieve. She says, this isn't about young people. Instead, the governor's shifting blame away from his policies and towards protesters, I guess referring to the many protesters out there, many of which were young, protesting police brutality lately. Similarly, via Twitter, Jennifer Charlene Toon, she says the recklessness of youth combined with conflicting messages from our governor, both are at fault behind leading to the spike in cases. Meanwhile, back on Facebook, David Noble says Abbott is not wrong. Try finding a generally healthy 20-something who isn't convinced of their own immortality. And also via Facebook, Joseph Vera says, I can tell you that it's people of all ages not adhering to guidelines. He notes that I live in a major metropolitan city and work in a small town, and as soon as things reopened, all of our guards went down. Leaders need to take responsibility for their failures. And as we've been hearing from people in communities all across Texas, this appears to be the case. We heard from the judge in Bexar County. We heard from some folks in Houston earlier in the social media segment. And Peter Moore on our Facebook page writes that here on North Padre Island, the disregard for social distancing cuts across generational lines. So obviously, folks seeing this and being borne out, the fewer number of people wearing masks and distancing, it appears, David.
It is an ongoing story here in Texas, one of many, and we will continue to track this and others over at texasstandard.org. We're out of time for the broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. On behalf of Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown, wishing you a very good Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.